So we want to talk more now about the history that was made last night. Sorry to shock you, but that's the sound of glass breaking in a video that was played at the convention last night. It was a reference to Hillary Clinton's famous line in 2008 when she conceded the race to Barack Obama but celebrated her own 18 million votes as cracks in that highest, hardest glass ceiling. Last night, she became the first woman nominated by a major party to run for president.
And I can't believe we just put the biggest crack in that glass ceiling yet.
She also gave a shout out to any young women who might be hoping to follow in her footsteps.
If there are any little girls out there who stayed up late to watch, let me just say, I may become the first woman president, but one of you is next.
So women politicians and supporters of Hillary's, including actress Meryl Streep, gave passionate speeches about history being made by a woman possibly headed for the White House. And many in the audience were shown wiping tears of emotion. Joining us now to talk more about what this means in the context of women's empowerment and leadership and Hillary Clinton's own career is Ellen Fitzpatrick, professor of history at the University of New Hampshire and author of the book, The Highest Glass Ceiling, Women's Quest for the Presidency. Welcome, Ellen.
Thank you.
Also joining us is Melissa Ludke. She's a former correspondent for Time magazine who wrote about Hillary Clinton's work on children and family issues way back in the 1980s, and she became and has remained a friend of Clinton's. Welcome, Melissa.
Well, thank you.
Listeners, we want to hear from you, too. What difference do you think it would make to have a woman in the White House? And is Hillary Clinton the right woman? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook or Twitter at Radio Boston. So, Ellen, let me start with you. How historic is this moment? Place it in the context of American history for us.
It's really an extraordinary milestone when you think about the fact that from 1870, when the first woman to set her sight on the American presidency, Victoria Woodhull, ran during Reconstruction to the present, over 200 women have sought, in one form or another, the American presidency, and none of them came anywhere near what Hillary Clinton has now achieved. So it's been a long, long quest.
200 women have tried.
Over 200.
I had no idea.
Most of them were quixotic candidacies and third-party tickets, and they didn't gain much traction. So the story of Clinton is really remarkable because she overcame the obstacles that stood in the way of all of her predecessors, every single one of them.
Well, Ezra Klein of Vox has written that Clinton employed what he called a, quote, less masculine strategy to win over the Democratic Party to her side. He talked about spending years slowly building relationships, creating coalitions, winning over allies. Is there a real difference, Ellen, in female leadership and coalition building, or is this because she's the wife of a former president?
I think that both are involved. That is, in some sense, Hillary Clinton came to public attention and therefore onto the national political stage in the most relied upon way for women traditionally to get attention, and that was through their husbands. It used to be called the widow's mandate. Happily, she's not a widow in achieving it, but they often filled out the term of a husband who was a congressman or a senator and therefore got some political clout in that manner. So that's how we got to know Hillary Clinton, through her two terms as first lady.
Well, let me ask you, as a nation, we seem to have trouble with celebrating women's history and sort of integrating it into the central national narrative. Why is that, Ellen?
Gee, that's a very good question. I wish I knew the answer to that, and I've been teaching women's history for several decades. Perhaps because women are, in some sense, really such a core presence in our life, in our society. And the tendency, I think, is to for them to serve quietly. And having a figure like Hillary Clinton, who has aggressively sought this office, is really out of sync with the prevailing notions of what women are like. And of course, this has been a great source of criticism of her as well, that she's aggressive.
Well, I was just going to say, you use that word aggressive, and it immediately draws to mind for me this quandary that Deborah Tannen, the Georgetown University linguist, has written about, the sort of difference between how we expect women to act and behave in the public sphere and private sphere and the way we expect leaders to behave.
Right.
And she and others have written about how we expect women to be soft and giving and self-effacing, and we expect leaders to be strong, maybe not bullies, but take charge. And that if a woman acts in that take charge role, that something rubs against us in a very sort of visceral, almost primal way, and that even many women themselves are put off by that. Is that part of the problem that Hillary Clinton faces, or any woman politician?
Yes, it's been shown. Some of the public opinion polls in the 20th century showed that many women were more opposed to the idea of a woman president than were men.
Is that true today or now, only in the past?
Now there is a consensus among most Americans who will say they're fine with the idea of a woman president. But the question is, what about this woman? Oh, well over 90% now. And when Shirley Chisholm ran in 1972, it was beginning to be a majority. But it's been quite a long march here. And it's kind of hard to imagine how someone could become president without being aggressive.
Yeah, well, that's a good point. Is it hard to imagine how someone can be in politics without assertively, aggressively going for their goals and going for the country's goals? I want to remind our listeners that you can join our conversation, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also tweet us at Radio Boston. If you want to join this conversation with two people who know an awful lot about women's leadership and about Hillary Clinton herself. So, Melissa, you covered Clinton when you were writing for Time magazine, and at the time she had worked in Massachusetts with the Children's Defense Fund. She later went on, of course, to be the wife of the governor of Arkansas and do a lot of important things in education in Arkansas, which were kind of an echo to the work she did here in Massachusetts. I understand Massachusetts was the first state to have mandated special education, in part because of work Hillary Clinton did. So tell us, as someone who's known her for decades and who's remained a friend of hers, what issues are important to her, and are these so-called women's issues?
Well, that's a very challenging question to answer briefly, but let me try. I would assert that children are at the core of everything that she thinks about. They are built into her DNA in terms of her thinking. That's when I first came to know her, you're right, when I was covering children's issues for Time magazine. And I was drawn to her through her work at the Children's Defense Fund, which had begun even when she was at Yale Law School and continued after that. We learned last night, and I'd known this for a while, that she took an extra year of law school to go to the Child Development School at Yale following it. She knew this was her path, and her path was really beginning in childhood when, through her church work, she had worked with children of migrant farming families. She had gotten to know children who lived in the city, not in the suburb that she lived in. She knew that there was something bigger than herself that revolved around the challenges that she saw so many children facing, even when she was young, then through her time at Yale, and then, of course, through her public service later on.
So it actually started out through church work, through her local Methodist church that she was involved with. That's interesting.
I think that's really right, yes.
All right, well, you know, let me ask you, we were talking a little bit now about the line that all women in leadership positions have to strike between being perceived as sweet but also being tough in order to be accepted. That's tough for everyone. But we've seen a particular venom aimed at Hillary Clinton, not just as a politician, but even when she was first lady. Is there something particular about her? The journalist Michelle Goldberg wrote in Slate that the motives for loathing Clinton have evolved, but the loathing itself has remained constant. Why do you think that is, Melissa?
Well, I'm frankly a little confused by that, because one of the things that I've observed over the three decades that I've known her and reported on her, that the zone that she's most comfortable in is one as a listener. I think people sort of made a little kind of a joke about her when she said she was going to do her listening tour as a senator. But frankly, every time I've watched her in any new realm, that realm has always included listening first. It hasn't meant sort of the bombastic speech making. In other words, I know best and now I'm going to tell you and I'm designating myself as your leader. She's always, since her days at Wellesley, been someone who's reached out to the different voices that are part of what she believes will be the solution. You'll notice that she didn't do the big rallies like Bernie Sanders did. I attended several town halls she did, and I have to say that in those town halls, people asked her questions, she engaged in a dialogue, and people came away, I think, very satisfied with the conversation they had, and I think they felt like they were listened to. So I think that a lot of this is driven by perceptions that aren't dealing with the reality.
Interesting. I want to come back to that. But right now, we have another very important voice on the line who I'd like to bring into this conversation. Dr. Paula Johnson is president of Wellesley College. Wellesley, of course, is the alma mater of Hillary Clinton herself. Welcome, President Johnson.
Thank you, Indira. It's wonderful to be here.
Oh, we're really happy to have you. And I know you're new in your job.
I am.
We're delighted to have you on.
A wonderful time
on the show now. Yes. So Hillary Clinton is probably the world's most famous Wellesley alum right now. As a place that strives to really instill in young women leadership skills, tell me, what does her nomination mean for Wellesley and for the message that you impart on your campus?
Well, you know, it's clearly an extraordinarily proud moment to have one of our alumnae make history for being the first woman to secure the nomination for a major party. And to have this nomination happen, it makes a tremendous difference for not only the young women of Wellesley, but I think for young women and for women and girls all across our country. I mean, it really is filling our students with a sense of hope for all possibilities. And it's so important that they can actually see themselves mirrored in a candidate for president.
Well, Dr. Johnson, you have actually spent your whole career fighting for health care for children and families. So is there a personal thing for you, a resonance in Clinton's nomination? And do you think she's going to achieve the goals that you have worked on as well?
I think that she will be extraordinary. And, you know, we know today that women's leadership is at a transformational moment. And in my work previously in the area of health and women's health, we know that women make tremendous impact when they are in leadership roles, and whether that be in public service, whether it be in corporations, whether it be in medicine, whether it be in education. And that having a woman as president is an extraordinary opportunity for these reasons. And I think as we think about the next generation looking to her, the future really does rely on this next generation of broad-minded and engaged and purposeful women to take on leadership roles and to have impact in our world.
Well, I have to ask you something about this next generation who you say, you know, need to be broad-minded. There were many young women at college campuses across the country, your own college campus included, who were passionate supporters of Bernie Sanders. And part of the reason they gave was that they didn't see it as such a big deal for a woman to be a candidate. What do you say to young women who may take equal rights for granted and who are perhaps unaware of inequities in pay and a glass ceiling that remains for women in the workforce or in politics?
Well, you know, the first thing I really share is that it's very important to be engaged. Whatever your party, whoever your candidate, the engagement is critical because that's really part of what we're doing on college campuses is really creating and helping to develop young people who are engaged. So whoever they were supporting, the fact that they were engaged and passionately engaged, I think is something that's very positive. And in a way, they're having the freedom to believe that there are many options is a wonderful thing. On the other hand, it's very important for us to ensure that young women have the data and understand what still needs to be done in our country for all the areas that you just mentioned. And you know, if we think about what we do, at particularly at women's institutions. You know, the founding of Wellesley College was really to empower women through education to make a difference. We don't dictate how they make a difference, but to make a difference. And that I think that symbolically having Hillary Clinton, though, as our nominee and as a potential president is a tremendous opportunity, and one that is transformational to the thinking of young women, even if they are not supporters.
Well, Bill Clinton, in his speech last night, tried to paint a picture of Hillary Clinton in a way to humanize her. And she is a woman who has had trouble telling her own story. I mean, I spent the 2008 campaign with her, covering her as a journalist, and covered her for 4 years as Secretary of State. And I see it in the way she interacts with people. Part of it is she has a fraught history with the media, and maybe she's a reserved person who's uneasy tooting her own horn. But Bill Clinton tried to tell some personal stories. He told one about dropping off Chelsea at Stanford for the first time.
There I was in a trance, just staring out the window, trying not to cry. And there was Hillary on her hands and knees, desperately looking for one more drawer to put that liner paper in.
So, you know, it's a funny, cute story. It shows her as a can-do person, a dedicated mom. But, Melissa, I want to ask you, mm-hmm. I know you're a mom yourself, does it also reinforce gender stereotypes in a way?
Oh, not now. Not anymore. It used to be that maybe women's issues were in one silo, and sort of it was something that women alone were supposed to address and supposed to just talk about amongst themselves. But that's no longer the feeling. And I want to just say a big hello to Dr. Johnson, the president of my college.
Oh, hello.
So thank you very much for joining the conversation.
Thank you for having me.
What it makes me know is that, you know, in talking with young women at Wellesley and at other schools who are there now, my daughter included, this is not a siloed issue anymore. This is something that women and men need to both be engaged in. And I think, you know, I'm not just saying that. Hillary said that along the way, that this isn't something that any longer is the women's only purview. You're never going to make progress if that's the only part of the population that's talking about it. So I say welcome everyone into the conversation and let's get going with it. She's laid out some very key issues, some of which were echoed by Ivanka Trump the other evening.
That's right.
You know, pay equity, child care. This is part of the conversation now. She is the person who can really make this conversation push forward because she's pragmatic. I want to share one quote with you from an interview that I did with her for one of our usual stories at Time Magazine, Is the Women's Movement Dead? You know, you always revisit this every 5 years. So we were talking about women's issues. I went back and found this quote. In the long run, if we are ever going to move the women's agenda forward, we have to figure out how to change what is in existence now. And meaning that we aren't going to be able to move outside of this realm to form a revolution about it. We have to work with what exists now. We have to figure out how to bring everyone to the table to talk about this. These are the skills that she's demonstrated through the years. These are the ones I see in her private life, in terms of the way she attacks issues and she maintains friendships.
Well, Bill Clinton called her the biggest change maker he's ever known. And of course, the story he was trying to tell is she may not be a fancy politician with a lot of flash and oratory, but she gets things done. That was the message clearly that he was trying to get across. The question is, again, as we were talking about, she's someone who's quite reserved and it's hard for her to tell her own story. So the question is, does she need to up her game in that, or can other people do it for her? I want to bring in some of our callers. Emily is calling us from Quincy. Emily, go ahead.
Hey, thank you, Paul. My question is...
Oh, I'm sorry, Emily. We can't hear you very well. Could you say that again, please?
Can you hear me now?
Yes, please go ahead.
Okay. My question is in regards to the evolution of Hillary Clinton. You know, a lot of people that have been brought out to talk about her in the past, and I heard you mention her, you know, as a young churchgoer and how that really played into her understanding of being a do-gooder and making change for the less fortunate. And I just see now, you know, on such a grandiose scale, how big that change seems. And to me, it's made her unrelatable, that I can't follow that track line from when she was a young woman and the small community changes she was making to where she is now running for president. And then just in addition to that, I try and be a big believer in principles over personalities. And with her, with so much growth and so much change, and obviously with ambition, I feel like I've seen changes in who she is and what she stands for. So her principles are hard for me to align with. I feel the same way about Donald Trump as a candidate as well. And so in this case, with two people whose principles and personalities I don't necessarily agree with, just speaking to her about how she's changed and maybe make her more relatable. Because I can't see the track line from being young and ambitious to and tying it all into who she is now. I feel like I can't marry those two.
Okay, thank you, Emily. It sounds like Emily is saying that she's hard to relate to. She started out as a small-town church do-gooder and now is seeking the most powerful seat in the country. You know, we were talking about that. That's the challenge for Hillary, to make herself appealing and relatable. Dr. Johnson, you're someone who has reached a very high seat as president of one of the major colleges in our country. I'm curious about your thoughts on how does one make oneself relatable when one is in a leadership position?
I think part of leadership is developing a sense of expertise and also the other characteristics that it requires that are required to lead. And I think that those have been studied over and over. They've been modeled over and over. So I don't think this is a mystery. It is through our education, it's through our experience, and through our training. And, you know, I think that that is what we've known, and it's not a mystery.
Can I speak to that just for a moment?
Yes, Melissa,
because I was thinking about this as I was coming over and trying to really get at Emily's point and think very hard about what I know of her childhood and those experiences and how they relate today. And I was thinking back to another president, and that was Lyndon Johnson. And really thinking that might have been the last time that we really heard a lot on the agenda about poor people and children and action and that. And if you think back, a story that he often told was of how he taught in a small school in rural Texas, and he taught a classroom of Mexican students. That experience stayed with him through all those years of his political leadership, and then formed what he himself talked about as sort of the core principles and beliefs that drove him to make those kind of policy decisions that he did.
I mean, part of the problem for Hillary Clinton is that she herself has said she's not the greatest, most natural politician. And she says of herself that, you know, the campaigning and the speechifying and electrifying audiences is not her strong suit. The sitting in a room and doing the policy work and bringing people together, that is. So it seems like the challenge is to make herself relatable and accessible and to tell people that story. But if you're not someone who naturally goes out and says that stuff about yourself the way that her husband or Barack Obama does, it makes it a really hard challenge. And that seems to be what our listener was getting at. Ellen.
I think to some extent that's very much overblown. This woman received 18 million votes in 2008 and 15 million votes in 2016. In 2008, more votes than any candidate, male or female, in American history in any presidential primary. This is not a politician who is loathsome to the public. The voters have, in fact, embraced her. It's how she got to where she is today. So to some extent, her self-effacement belies, I think, something else, which is a remarkably effective career as a politician that got her where she is today.
Interesting. And I think we have a listener, Mitch from Hull, who says in his comment that Clinton was really demonized by the GOP mm-hmm. when she was first lady and tried to pick up universal health care. And his point is that they have been attacking her ever since for more than two decades, so that's part of what has contributed to her reputation. Well, let me ask you, Dr. Johnson.
I'm sorry, I'm going to have to get off.
All right. Well,
thank you
so much, Dr. Paula Johnson is the president of Wellesley College. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And to Melissa and Ellen, let me then just ask you, with the short time we have left, you know, what do you say to women who say, I want to vote for a woman, but Hillary's not the woman I want to vote for? What's the response to that?
My response would be turn around and do what she does, and that is listen. Really listen to the things that she's talking about that she wants to achieve and wants to get done. Trust that if she wants to get them done, she will work as hard as a human being can work to try to get them done. And listen. That's what I would say.
And Ellen, to you, last question is, Donald Trump has tried to use her femaleness against her, saying that she's playing the woman card and that she wouldn't be where she is were she not a woman or the wife of an ex-president. What do you say to that? What should her response be?
I think that the appropriate response is that the woman card is played the minute a woman enters the presidential race. It's on the table. And the question is, does it play high or low in the game? And I think, you know, what I would say, I have to weigh in on this previous question, is that I hope that people will look at the history of what it took for women to get to this point. If they're waiting for the perfect female candidate, they're going to be waiting a very long time.
Interesting. It's an interesting thought. All right, I'm going to take one last caller, Jonathan from Charlestown. Go ahead, Jonathan.
Hi, I just wanted to kind of weigh in on Hillary's potential impact globally opposed to just nationwide. If she does become president, she'll arguably be the leader of the free world and the most powerful person on earth. And doing business with countries in the Middle East where women don't even have the right to drive and have to go out with
in Saudi Arabia specifically, of course.
Exactly. She'll be doing business with those countries, and women in those countries will see that the leader of the free world does not have to abide by those rules. And I think it'll bring, you know, a rising tide will raise all ships, and in that sense, where it'll be great for women globally to see that that is not the standard, at least in the West.
All right. Thank you, Jonathan. So, you know, he makes an excellent point that it can be a role model and a message for the whole world, not just for the U.S. I mean, one last thought I have is that the Equal Rights Amendment to the Constitution was first proposed in 1923. Think about that. And 100 years later, we still don't have that. So I just wonder, even if a woman is elected, is she, in the reality of our political context, actually going to be able to make as much of a difference for women as she hopes to?
Well, I think we can only think back to 1995 when she stood in Beijing, China, and uttered the words, you know, women's rights are human rights and human rights are women's rights. And those words and that speech and her courage in delivering them at that point, it wasn't a popular thing to do within the administration. She went ahead because she believed that that was an important role that she could play globally for women. And as Secretary of State, she continued that work with women and girls in her tenure.
That's Melissa Ludke, a former Time magazine correspondent who first covered Hillary Clinton back in the 1980s and became a longtime friend. We also spoke with Ellen Fitzpatrick, professor of history at the University of New Hampshire and author of The Highest Glass Ceiling, Women's Quest for the Presidency. Thank you so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, we'll be talking with a former American diplomat and Harvard professor, Nick Burns, on Hillary Clinton's foreign policy. I'm Indira Lakshmanan. This is Radio Boston.